Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. My guest this evening is Pupa Dweck from Deal. She is the author of a monumental, beautifully produced cookbook by the name of Aromas of Aleppo. What differentiates her cookbook from most other kosher cookbooks, in fact, almost every kosher cookbook I've ever seen, is it deals with far more than just recipes. It deals with the history and the culture of a 2,500-year-old community, a community that has been around since the time of King David. It deals with migrations of those who came after the expulsion from Spain. It deals with the suffering. It deals with the culture produced by that community. As a cookbook, it is the size of a coffee table book. It is heavily printed on heavy stock, heavy paper, with the quality of an art book. The photography at once shows a certain rusticity and a sedate elegance. I have never seen anything like it. I have never seen anything like it before. It is one of the most beautiful cookbooks I have ever seen. This evening, we will speak to Ms. Pupa Dweck.
Hello.
Who has authored... Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi,
hello?
Mrs. Dweck. How are you?
Hello.
Yes,
hello.
Can you hear me?
Thank you. Yes, I could hear you very well.
Okay. Excellent.
So,
tell us a little bit about how the idea of this cookbook came to mind. How long did you work until you brought it to fruition?
Okay. So, actually, when so many have asked Pupa, how long have you worked on this monumental cookbook, not just the cookbook, but the history and the traditions? And what comes to my mind all the time is, I have to say, I've been working on it really all my life. From when I was a little girl and I was brought up with my parents, who were both descendants of Aleppo, Syria, they brought me up with the Syrian homemade food and the traditions and the culture. I felt so closely connected to everything that was so meaningful, not just the food, but the rituals. And I always felt deep in my heart that I needed to capture it. I needed to capture and document our wonderful cuisine, our deep history, starting from the time of Abraham, actually. The Syrian name for Aleppo, Chaim, is Heleb, which many
Heleb,
don't know.
Right.
Heleb, right. And
right.
That name was from the legend of Abraham traveling to Canaan and stopping at the hilltops of Aleppo. And he milked his goats and gave the milk to the poor. And in Arabic, Heleb means it translates as milk. So the first Jew gave us our Arabic name. And like you mentioned in the introduction, you know, from the time of King David, Jews have lived in Aleppo. And Aleppo is one of the longest and oldest continuously inhabited cities since the beginning of time. So there was so much history and so much culture that I needed to share with the rest of the world. Not only to let the rest of the world and give that window to the rest of the world and other groups of people to understand our community, but I also felt very deeply that I wanted other communities to appreciate their backgrounds and appreciate their connection and culture and traditions through food in their way, that it's not just the Syrian Jews of Aleppo that have something to preserve. We all have legacies. So I knew that I wanted to start with mine. And that's where it all started. That's how it started.
Okay. It is quite obvious that this was a work of love. As one leaps through the pages, as one reads,
yes,
the what you wrote, as one looks through the photography, there is no question about that. But what qualified you specifically, what qualified Pupa the Wet to write this?
Well, my mother taught me how to cook. She, in Halab, was a renowned cook. And when in the United States, she taught me all the wonderful dishes. And I think it was my passion, actually, that qualified me to become the author. There's many people who in the community that know about the history and know about the culture and know about our renowned rabbis and the ingredients and the rituals of the holidays and all the different foods that are connected. But why was it me? It's because of the passion that I had for it. And I knew that it had to get documented. So, you know, if it wasn't me, maybe another person would have done it. But I think that I was the one who had the destiny to capture the history of Aleppo and to bring it. Today, what's amazing, Chaim, is that today there just is a handful of Jews living in Aleppo. For the first time in over 2,500 years, there's not a Jewish community in Aleppo. There's a few elderly and then just a few businessmen still there. But in the rest of the world, globally, you could go to San Paulo, to London, to the flagship community of Brooklyn, to Mexico City, Panama City, Bogota, where Colombia, where I was recently invited on book tour. It's like they transplanted the communities from Aleppo and brought them to these countries. And they're still eating the same foods, following the same traditions. And it's like the community doesn't have a home, but yet we are all at home. And it's something. My sons are married now, but when they used to travel to relatives in Geneva, in London, in San Paulo, all over the world, they would come home and tell me, Ma, the food tasted exactly like yours. We could shut our eyes, and we were eating the same foods. And the pizmonim, which were the songs that they would sing on Shabbat, were exactly the same. And it's the distinguishing foods that really keep us connected. For example, recently I wrote for the website The Jew and the Carrot about the chubis adi, which is a ordinary Syrian flatbread. When I was growing up, I didn't even know what challah was, believe it or not. We would have the 12 pita breads, the 12 chubis adis, which would symbolize and correspond to the 12 tribes for the temple. At the temple,
right.
at the altar, and that would be our bread. And I didn't even, there wasn't even challah. The word challah I didn't learn about till, I think, right after I got married. And then my children went to yeshiva, and they brought the concept of challah to the house. And then we had challah for a little bit, but then we went right back to the chubis adi. And what's amazing, I'll tell you something else about the food. My mother would always tell me, Pupa, the food from Halab was the most quayes, the most tayyib, the most delicious, the most beautiful in the whole world, in the whole Middle East. And knowing the love that I had, my mother had for the culture and for the cuisine, I didn't take it too seriously. I felt like, you know, this is hers. But as I started doing more and more research for Aromas of Aleppo, I realized that Aleppo was the Mecca of cuisine in the Middle East. It was called the Pearl of the Arab Kitchen. And now you might ask me why. Why was the food there so special as opposed to Damascus,
right,
or Beirut or Lebanon? Why? And I have to tell you, Aleppo was at the crossroads of the major trade routes. They had the largest camel caravans coming through Aleppo. The exotic spices, the cardamom, the camoun, the coriander, all the turmeric, the spices, the silk trade that came through Aleppo was the largest in the entire Middle East. Then there was also the fact that Aleppo was part of the Fertile Crescent, which gave way to the luscious orchards, which gave them the magnificent fruits and vegetables. My mother and I would go shopping in farmers markets, and I would go for the organic produce and look at it like it was jewelry, and she would tell me, oh, Poopa, what we had in Aleppo, what we had in the souks, what we had in the markets can't even compare. And it was known. And that's one of the special dishes are the stuffed vegetables. I don't know if, you know, your viewers know that. We call it mehshi, which is
right.
any stuffed vegetable with that stuffed, any vegetable that's stuffed with a meat and rice filling that's seasoned with allspice. Now, the reason Aleppo was known as the queen of the mehshis was because the vegetables were so beautiful, from eggplant to zucchini, onions, peppers, potatoes, everything was stuffed. And it was seasoned with tamarind. Now, in the entire Middle East, the only city, the only town that uses tamarind as the sweet and souring agent is Aleppo. The rest of the Middle East will use pomegranate juice.
Right.
Which is really interesting. Go ahead.
I noticed something very, very interesting as I was going through the book. Very surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the recipes that you had there were exactly recipes that my mother used to make that I remember as a kid. And remember, not only am I Ashkenazi, but I'm from Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, none of my cousins would make those same recipes, only my mother. Her name mm-hmm. was certainly, her maiden name was certainly an Ashkenazic name.
Mm-hmm.
No hint of Sephardi. And yet none of my Ashkenazic friends or Ashkenazic relatives used to make those dishes. For example, one very, very easy to make dish, which I used to look forward to every year, which you have in your book, was the purple eggs.
Yes. Yes,
I couldn't believe it. Finally, I found somebody who actually knows about that dish. And then I realized it's a Syrian dish. Now, the question is, where would my mother, a Polish lady, where would she have gotten that?
It's a good question. I know where the Aleppian community got it from, and it came from Spain. A lot of the dishes, many of the dishes, came from Spain. It's called, in Arabic, it's called bed hamin, slow-cooked eggs. And that's one mm-hmm. of the dishes we got from Spain. And also from Spain, we got the artichokes that are cut in half, artichoke medias, which are meat-stuffed artichokes that are cut in half. The
right.
concept,
my mother
so
also
many of
used
the,
to make that.
Yes,
and
then, for example,
again, none of my cousins, none of my friends used to even know what it was. Everybody used to come to my house for it.
Yes, yes. So she had some Sephardic, she had some Halabi friends, possibly. And also, but, you know, what's amazing is the different influences. The reason the cuisine is so renowned is between the exiles that went through the country and stayed, and the conquerors. And then what really brought it to its apex was during the time of the Ottoman Empire, with the wealth and the cooking for the caliphs and the princes and the sultans, only the finest ingredients were used. And the free-range chickens were plentiful, and the pistachios, and the, you know, the different, the basmati rice. And, you know, rice at that time was a luxury. The first grain was actually the cracked wheat, which is bugrul in Arabic. So the cuisine that developed in Aleppo was something that really had to get documented. It's not only the cuisine, it's also the women and the religiosity in the women and the men, how they carried on their religious customs till today. We had in Aleppo, the rabbis were also renowned and known for being, you know, really elevating the Jewish world during that time. You know, it was still Palestine at the mm-hmm. time. And right. Maimonides was quoted as saying that Aleppo at his time was the light for the Jewish world because of the rabbis and the religiosity. And today it still is going on. The men go to shul. We have Shabbat is a main part of the week. And what's amazing is that the women still respect and embrace Shabbat. And even though today the women are working, they're highly educated, many of them are holding jobs, but yet when it comes to Shabbat, it's a priority. And they embrace it and they don't think of it as a job. And that to me is a phenomenon. One of my favorite chapters in the book is a chapter called Safir. Did you see that? It
yes.
describes the woman's place in the home. Safir in Arabic mm-hmm. translates as orderliness, but it's really so much more than that. To say that a woman has Safir is the greatest compliment that you could give a woman from the Halabi community. And what it means is that there's a sense of peace in the house. There's a sense of security. You will see a woman with Safir greeting a guest, whether it's someone she knows or doesn't know, with happiness. The coffee is brewing. She would say to Fadalu right away, like, welcome, welcome. You would see her praying. You would see her praying Tehillim, the Psalms. She would have a sixth sense about the family issues. So today, a woman takes a very big pride in her position in the home, even though she still today is modern, her garb is modern, still modest, but modern. She's educated, she could be working, but there's still that sense of Safir, which is just, to me, I needed to write about that. There was so much that I needed to know was between two covers of a beautiful book. So, and I made sure the photography was also beautiful, because I know that that really draws the audience.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what are some of the most ancient of the recipes that you have in your book?
Okay, the stuffed vegetables that are stuffed with the meat and rice filling called mechshis are really a very old recipe because it's from the Persian influence. That is where we developed the dishes using dried apricots and dried fruits. That's a very Turkish and Persian recipe. Also, even older than that, the oldest recipes, I would have to say, were the cracked wheat, the bugrul, cooked with chickpeas and butter. Because the cracked wheat was plentiful. They would have big harvesting times, from biblical times even. They would harvest the cracked wheat and let it dry, and it would be a whole community effort. So all the dishes cooked with the bugrul would be the very beginning of the – those are the oldest recipes. But as far as the authenticity – yes.
I was going to ask if there are any recipes that could be traced to the very first – Jews in Aleppo.
Actually, all of them. I mean, these were the especially the rice pudding, all the dishes that were cooked, like I said, with the cracked wheat, the lamb from the beginning, lamb was cooked on Shabbat, chicken was cooked from the beginning of time. Everything stayed authentic. What's amazing is these recipes were cooked. The same recipes in my book were cooked centuries ago. I had a special meeting with Imad Mustafa, and he's the Syrian ambassador to the U.S., and I had breakfast with him, and he told me that he showed the book to his mother. They went over it page by page in Aleppo, in Syria, and she looked at him and told him in Arabic that every recipe is authentic and every recipe is the way we prepared them centuries ago. Like, nothing changed. That's what was amazing. But what happened was, the reason I felt so compelled to document it was that it's a similar situation in other groups, is that it was a pinch of this and a handful of that and no time,
right,
and no amounts, and that was the difference. So the reason the book is so successful, especially in the Middle Eastern communities, not just Jewish, is that now we have these authentic recipes that are centuries old, really perfect. Every recipe is perfect. The measurements, what I did was I had chefs come to my home and that knew absolutely nothing about the Syrian cuisine. And I would give them the recipe and the ingredients and have them prepare it. And that's when I realized the invisible steps that were not being written. And I realized that the taste wasn't exactly the way I wanted. A little more lemon, a little more salt, a little more allspice, a little more Aleppo pepper. And I have grandmothers and I have non-Jewish Muslim community members calling me and telling me the recipes are perfect. They're authentic. So this is, when you're telling me which were the beginning recipes, these as a whole, these were the recipes.
Now, let me ask you something. Going back to the recipes, you have any interesting stories as you were doing your research? Do you have any interesting stories in relation to some of the recipes? Any interesting or funny stories that you care to share?
Well, what I loved was how powerful. One of the stories that really touched my heart was when I was in Beijing. I was doing a food demonstration in one of the for one of the groups of women, and she came over to me with tears in her eyes. She was Persian, and she said for the first time she realized that she could be a working woman and a homemaker and get her hands into the food and still look modern and be in the 21st century. So that was one of the messages that I felt like the book gave. And that's why when you look through the book, you see that I'm dressed, that the women are dressed, but yet we're still cooking and taking care of our homes. So it's not just one or the other. So that's one of the epiphanies that I had while I was working on the book and while I was, actually it was after the book that I realized that was very important. Oh, I have a great story. I just thought of one. Okay. I had a fundraiser in my home, and I made a table of candied fruit, and vegetables, actually, that was very popular in Syria. Was nothing got wasted. So, grapefruit rinds and orange rinds and even little baby eggplants were candied in this beautiful rose water fragrant syrup with cloves, actually, the little baby eggplants. So I served a beautiful silver platter. It was on a silver platter of baby candied eggplants. One of the women walked into the house and said to me, "Oh, Pupa, I can't believe it. When my daughter was born, my Aunt Leila gave me a jar of candied baby eggplants. I said, well, how many years ago was that? She told me 30. I said, okay, where? She says, and I still have the jar. I said, what are you talking about? She said, yes, I still have the jar. I didn't open it. And everybody told me that, you know, it stays and it's a preservative. She ran home and got it. And it was over 200 people in my house. And we opened the jar and we put one on a plate. And then we put mine on a plate and we tasted both of them. And they were both delicious and they were both great. And it's known
after
in
30
our
years?
Yes. And in our community,
wow,
there's many documented instances where, because the sugar acts as a preservative, so there's actual documented instances, even in my own family, but not as far back, where grandmothers have served their candied eggplant at their great-granddaughter's engagement parties.
Wow.
So, I don't know if that's the story you were looking for, but
that is incredible. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was one beautiful story that I thought was very nice. And okay, you know, what other
okay. Now, you finally got this book out in 2007, I believe, right?
Yes.
Okay. What did you do as far as food after that? Do you do cooking demos and so on?
Yes. Well, I was invited by Afer Unsal. She's a renowned journalist and food historian from Istanbul. And she invited me to Turkey. And we had in a restaurant, we cooked together. And then we had a dialogue between Muslim, Christian, Ashkenaz Jews, Turkish Jews, Sephardic Jews, all women. And we had a beautiful conversation about food, about family, about tradition, and how important the connection is between our traditions and how food is such a powerful vehicle. And at the end of the meeting, we all realized that as women, we all felt the same, that we wanted to keep our traditions alive because we knew that that's what would keep families strong, and that if families were strong, the world would be stronger, and that food was a step to have dialogue. And it was beautiful. It was really quite beautiful. And I felt like just at that moment, it was already worth the effort for the book, just from that.
Absolutely.
So that was very, yes, that was beautiful. And then I got to go to the Egyptian spice market. It was magnificent. It was like I felt that I was in the souks of Aleppo all over again. They had the Turkish Delight piled high, which is the, you know, the jellied candies. They
mm-hmm.
had mounds and mounds of all the spices. And it was serpentine, just like I felt like I was in Aleppo again. So that was nice. That was very nice.
Well,
even as an Ashkenazic
Jew, as I was going through the book,
mm-hmm.
not only could I practically feel the love that must have gone into producing it, but as I looked through those recipes, I mean, I was fascinated. Even the ones that were not done by my mother, there were so many things that I just had to try. And a couple of nights ago, right before I wrote the review on the Kosher Sin Blood, I made the recipe that I actually quoted, the one about the tamarind stewed meatballs. They were
mm-hmm.
absolutely incredible.
Do you
never
know
tasted
how many
anything
of those
like that in a meatball.
Yes. Do you know I have to make a pot? I can't tell you how high of those meatballs every Shabbat for all the grandchildren. I, no matter how many I prepare, they go. That's
there is never enough.
Their, there's never enough, and I just keep, Grandma, do you have the meatballs? Do you have? They love them. They really are quite delicious. And everything, you know, it just, it's, it, It's not even an acquired taste. There's just a lot of flavor, but I always say that it's more than the food. You know, I'm a big believer of the food. You know, I love the food and I love the spices. And for example, when my daughter Sarine was newly married a year and a half ago, she went to Israel with her husband, and she called me from the market Machane Yehuda, and she said to me, "Ma, what can I get you?" And she's, "Never mind, I really know what the answer is." And she knew what I wanted was the fresh cardamom pods, because she knows that every Shabbat, when I grind those little cardamom pods in my pepper mill and over the chicken, that aroma brings me back to my mother. And when I smell it and when I feel the fragrance, it's like I have my mother passed on over 15 years ago. So mm-hmm. She knows that when I have that moment, it's like a visit for me. This is how powerful the connection of food is. It's not just to satiate our hunger and to nourish our bodies. It's to bring us, it transcends that. As much as I'm a foodie and I love food, it transcends that. And that was my message. That was my message. Now what's interesting is I, with my vegetable garden, I go and I cut fresh mint with my, I have fruits and I have vegetables and herbs, but I go out with my granddaughter and we cut mint and we dry it together and we put it in bags and we give it out as gifts. And we put it on everything. We put it on lamb. We put it on yogurt. We put it on everything we eat. We make tea with it. And it's a way to share a time. It's a way to share a flavor together. And that's what the food's about. That it's so much more than just, like I said, nourishing our bodies.
Mm-hmm. And we are just about out of time, so I want to thank you for coming on our show. You were a superb guest. There are so many questions I still have to ask you. I'm going to have to ask you to come back again.
Okay, it'd be my pleasure. And I wish everybody a wonderful summer, and keep cooking.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And thank you very, very much for being on our show. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. Have a good night, and come back to listen to us again next week, right here on the Kosher Scene Internet Talk Radio. Thank you very much, and good night to one and all.